Look, he said, we didn't get where we are by me prying into things you didn't want pried into. I don't want to change that now. But yes, Bobby's worried about you. I am too. We're going into some pretty dangerous times here, and if there's anything that you need to get off your chest, now is a better time than later. Amos shrugged. Nah, I get it. I got a little happy when we went out on that last run. Opened up sooner than Babs would have liked. I'll rein in some if it makes her feel better. I don't want to make an issue of it, Holden said. It ain't an issue then, Amos said, turning back to the conduit. He took a thick pair of pliers from his pocket, clamped them over the power cable, and started wrestling it out like he was getting crab meat out of a shell. It looked really dangerous. I'll play nice, cross my heart. Okay then, Holden said. Great, glad we had this talk. Anytime, Amos said. Holden hesitated, turned and walked away. Bobby was right. He didn't know what was going on in Amos's mind, but something definitely was. He was hard-pressed to think what the good version of that looked like. And if Amos was finally coming off the rails, he had no idea what would cause it, or how to fix it. Chapter 29. Bobby. The representatives from the Voltaire Collective entered the meeting space like they were anticipating an attack. She would have felt the same if the positions were reversed. Three in the front with unencumbered hands, three in the back looking around like tourists coming to a casino for the first time in case something interesting or threatening would come from behind, and in the center, Katria Mendez. Her face was the expressionless calm of a player at a poker table, the kind that always left with more chips than she came with. Just seeing her made Bobby's cheek throb a little. Psychosomatic pain, but pain all the same. She registered the sensation, but didn't let it bother her. Saba stepped forward, Holden at his side, and greeted them, waved them forward with smiles and belter salutes. He let them check him for weapons first, as a kind of social courtesy, and Holden did the same. The old phrase from back in the day came to Bobby's mind. There's OPA, and there's OPA. Same now as it had been then. It was always a little eerie to see how comfortably the men and women of the transport union fell back into being criminals, and how well she and the crew of the Rosie fit in with them when they did. Amos stretched his shoulders and neck. I know, Bobby said. I don't like it either. Don't recognize the one with the nose, Amos said, pointing with his chin toward Katria's bodyguard. The other ones, I'm pretty sure we danced with. Bobby considered their faces. The one Amos was talking about stood in the rear, just behind Katria. He had olive skin, close-cropped hair, and a long nose that had been broken a couple times and not set right. A white scar marked one nostril like someone had slit it for him once. She was pretty sure she'd have remembered him if she'd run into him before. The others, she wasn't as certain. Katria, obviously, and two of her guards at the front all seemed familiar enough. Maybe we'll get to know him, Bobby said. Now, you're just flirting with me, Babs. Promising a good dust-up when everyone else is here for talking. Yeah, well, Bobby said, a girl can dream. The banter felt almost normal, but she wasn't easy with it. Not yet. She was plenty willing to play along for the moment, though. Katria caught her eye and nodded. Bobby smiled, her cheek pulling at its new scab, and nodded back. It could have been respect between equals or the handshake at the start of a fight. Bobby figured they'd all find out which soon enough. The meeting space was new to her. A long, thin room that had been part of the water recycling system recently enough that it still smelled a little bit of wet plant and sewage. Twice as long as it was wide, there was enough space for the Rosi crew, Saba, and a half-dozen of his most trusted crew. The ones who already knew the plan. It wasn't a pleasant spot, but the cartography of the underground's borders were shifting now, more and more often. The Laconian surveys had been finding the holes in the system surveillance, denying them free access to the corridors and units they'd made their own. They'd been spending more and more of their time in the monitored public spaces. Part of that had been reconnaissance for her plan. Part of that had been that there were fewer and fewer spaces left on Medina where they could speak freely. All through the station, there were soldiers and crowd suppression drones. It didn't bother her, passing the people with haunted eyes, walking like the deck might be too fragile to support their mass. She understood them. The others, the ones who were laughing and talking and listening to music loud enough that she could hear the bass, bothered her more. They were acting like the open-air prisons and the power-armored marines. The communications control and shift curfews were normal. And because of that, they were. It wouldn't be long before the Laconians started shipping through the slow zone again. Maybe she and the others would be allowed back on the Rosi when that happened. But Bobby found it hard to believe there wouldn't be monitors placed in there, too. It could take Naomi and Clarissa days or weeks to purge them all and make their ship fully their own again. And by then, it would be too late anyway. Every day, every hour, brought the typhoon's arrival closer. And once it had cleared the Laconia Gate, staying ahead of the occupying forces became orders of magnitude more difficult. Which was the optimist's way of saying impossible. Bobby felt the pressure of time slipping away like she was watching a door close, with her on the wrong side of it. If it hadn't been for the time pressure, she wouldn't have gone along with Saba's suggestion to reach out to the Voltaire Collective, or at least not so soon after she and Amos had kicked their asses. The only good thing was that Katria and her people were just as screwed as Saba and Bobby and Holden, and by the same things. "So," Katria said once the requisite sniffing was done, "I'm surprised at having so civil a meeting. I have to think you need something from me you can't manage by yourselves." Saba smiled, but waved his hand twice sharply. "Too many years, Sasa. Come, sit with me in mine, have a drink, and we'll talk about what we talk about." Katria crossed her arms. "It's not you," Holden said. "It's just that the fewer people know about this, the less chance someone gets picked up by security. You can't tell anyone what you don't know, right?" Katria Mendez looked from Saba to Holden, and then pointedly over to where the Rosi crew were sitting. Not just Bobby and Amos, but Naomi and Alex and Clarissa besides. "So, none of mine, but all of theirs?" "All of theirs already know," Saba said. "They're who wants to talk with you most." "They have strange ways of showing it," Katria said. "This is my house," Saba said. "My salt on it, yeah? Parley. And if it's nothing, it's nothing. But we're under the same thumb, you and me. Not asking you to love anyone. Just listen to." For a moment, Katria hesitated. Her scowl bit into her cheeks like it was going for bone. Bobby had a brief flash of certainty that the whole Voltaire Collective was about to turn and walk away without even hearing her pitch, and she was more than a little relieved at the idea. "It's bullshit," the one with the nose spat. "They're just trying to get you on your own, okay? Make you not be here, that's all. It's all of us or none." "It's my call, Jordao," Katria snapped, "not yours." The one with the nose, Jordao, apparently, stepped back, sulking. Holden was smiling like a salesman, as if his radiant goodwill could warm up every other interaction in the room. It left him looking more than a little ridiculous, but damned if Katria didn't consider him for a long moment and chuckle. "If I refuse, then we all took a long walk for nothing," she said. Holden beamed. Bobby wasn't sure how he did it. The way he could disarm a situation with his almost palpable guilelessness astonished her every time. "Thank you," Holden said. "I really appreciate this." Saba lifted a hand, and two of his people ghosted in from the corridor and led Katria's guard away. Standing by herself, she didn't seem any less imposing. The door to the corridor slid shut, and the bolt clicked. It was as near to privacy as anyone on Medina could have. "So," Katria said, "what's on your mind?" Bobby took a long breath, let it out between her teeth. The idea had been hers from the start, and she'd been mulling it over for days. She hadn't slept as much as she wanted. Even when she hadn't been reviewing it and looking for holes in the plan, she'd felt too jagged and amped up to sleep. Part of that had been thinking about how to make the approach she was going for now. "There's a single point of contact between the Laconian destroyer and Medina," Bobby said, "and we have a bug on it." Katria's eyes went a degree wider. She glanced over to Saba, who nodded. It was true. Katria didn't sit, but her weight settled into her hips a little. Bobby had her attention. That was good. "The encryption isn't breakable," she said. "Not from the outside. The Martian codes it's based on are solid. We might be able to crack them if we had between now and about a decade on, but we're down to a countable number of days. So we've got enough intelligence gathered to fill libraries that we can't read. But I think we can fix that." She plucked her hand terminal out of her pocket, slaved it to Saba's local system, and pulled up the schematic of Medina that she'd been using. The cavernous center of the drum, command and control on one end, engineering and the docks and the massive but quiescent engines on the other. The elevator shafts that ran between them outside the surface of the drum, and also the ships in the dock, including, highlighted in red, the gathering storm. "The longer goal is that we find a way to disable the storm here. Shut down Medina's sensor arrays and distract or isolate the security forces on Medina long enough to let all these ships get off station and out through the rings before their reinforcements from Laconia get here. The short-term goal," she zoomed in on a small red mark inside Medina proper near the docks, "is this." "And that is?" Katria asked. "It used to be backup power storage," Bobby said, "but since our guests from Laconia got here, it's been repurposed." "The thing is," Alex said, breaking in, "these Laconia fellas, they were all Martians to start, or their leadership were, anyway. And they were serving just a little bit after me and Bobby here did our tours." He looked from Bobby to Katria to Saba and then back. Bobby nodded him on. Alex licked his lips. "One of the things we trained on was how to go about securing an enemy station," he said, which wasn't true. It was something Bobby had trained to do, not him. Storm and control the homes and communities of Belters. If there was going to be a sore spot, this would be it. It was why Alex was saying it instead of the woman who'd cleaned Katria's clock and left her zip-tied to her friends. It seemed less likely to rub on Katria wrong that way. "You heard of air gap encryption strong rooms?" Katria's eyes were brighter. She hadn't, but she didn't want to admit that. Alex licked his lips again, shot a look from Bobby to Katria and back to Bobby, then went on. "One thing that we did was maintain physical separation between whatever ship was taking control and the local systems. Lay in a pipe to one of our own boxes on the station and send any commands we wanted for the base there. Communications, control protocols, everything. It gets unencrypted there and set on to one-time physical media to walk over to the local system. No live connections at all. Bullshit, Katria said. It's standard, Bobby said, and is part of why no one was ever able to hack back into a Martian ship from a controlled station. And since the Laconians are basing their protocols on Martian ones, this is where that machine is. But the lag time, Katria shook her head. That's impressive. The room is crewed by two people, always. The door is physically locked, not connected to the security grid, no electronic interface, old-school bolt and key, and no keyhole on the outside. Can't be hacked into remotely. Can't be circumvented easily, Bobby said. And a full complement of guards at shift change. Katria took control of the model, zooming farther in on the encryption vault. Her face was thoughtful, which was better than Bobby had hoped. It made her nervous to talk about this. I see, Katria said. You can't get in without making a lot of noise and calling in the cavalry. Is that why you need me? To blow the door? No, Bobby said. We have a way in. We need your help to cover it up once we're done. Katria traced a slow circle with her fingers. Go on. Clarissa picked up the thread. The room is still connected to the environmental system. But if we put a team here... She pulled the model back to a larger frame and touched the power junctions near engineering. We can shut down the fans and open the carbon dioxide scrubbers and recycling systems. Choke them out? Katria asked. Alex shook his head. Make a path to pilot some little drones in. Half a dozen of them with point blasting charges. Take down the two guards, then use the rest to pop the lock. He made a little boom sound with his lips and opened two fists in the physical cartoon of an explosion. Bobby pointed toward Naomi. She has a snapshot cloning deck. I'll have a crowbar and a hammer. We get in, make a full-state copy of the encryption box, and get out to the hardened radiation shelter. Bobby moved the model. Here. And then you come in. If los security coyos know we stole their codes, Saba said, leaning against the wall, they change things up, yeah? Not just new crypts, but new procedures. Everything we've got turns into a whole lot less. So they can't know what we do, even after it's done. Holden pulled the model out to show where the storm was docked against the side of the station. We need to give them a different story. The storm's parked here, and the primary liquid oxygen storage tanks are right here. If that blows out, it will look like we're trying to blow up the storm, but Tycho built this place well. Lots of redundancy and fail-safes. There's an explosion relief route that'll vent the pressure blast out along this pathway here, which takes out the communications vault, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. You want to blow our air out as cover? Katria said. I think you may owe us an apology. We're usually the ones who are called extreme. Not our air, Saba said. Theirs, as soon as they came here. We're breathing on their grace, us. Plus, those tanks are docked ship refills, not for the habitat. And there will be plenty in the secondary and tertiary tanks, Holden said. Remember, lots of redundancy, lots of fail-safes. And Tycho's original design remembers longer than the people living in it do. Katria went quiet for a long time. Bobby felt the anxiety growing in her gut. It had been a mistake to bring the Voltaire Collective in on this. It didn't matter how much Saba trusted them or how good they were with demolitions. She should have kept it just within her own crew, where she could control it, where she was sure of everyone. "I don't like it," Katria said, shaking her head. "A lot of moving parts. The more pieces there are, the more ways there are for it to break." Bobby shrugged. "If the time wasn't so short, I'd do something simpler. All we need is the right bomb, the right place," Saba said. "You give us those, and we take the mission from there." "No," Katria said. "You need the charges. You need someone to put the charges in the right places at the right time. And need someone on the remote switch who doesn't panic and throw it a little too early and take out your team. And even if they don't, do you think someone in a rad shelter is going to live through that blow?" Naomi cleared her throat. "They're rated for it. But you're right. We can't know until we try. What's the evac plan once your little Armageddon is over?" Katria asked. It was more than Bobby had wanted to say. There should be some parts of the plan that weren't being shared. Saba paused, weighing whether to bring Katria that far in. When he spoke, his voice was surly. He didn't like having his hand forced any more than Bobby did. "Vac suits in the shelter. Go out through the hole. The same airlock we used to bug the line the first time, we use it to get back in." Katria took control of the model again, turning it, moving through the lower reaches of Medina deck by deck. "It's going to kill people," she said. "When the engineering decks start breathing vacuum, not everyone's going to make it to the shelters." "Savvy," Saba said. "As a price. Is it one you'd pay?" "Is," Saba said. But Holden's expression had a distance to it. Bobby could tell what was in his mind. There could be innocent people on the decks when the time came. At best, their plan would risk them. At worst, some would be killed. If Saba and Katria were bothered by the idea, they didn't show it. Holden was bothered by it. She wondered if he'd stand on principle and scrub the whole thing. It was even money, knowing him. "Demolition team goes here," Katria said. "Plant the charges, then fall back to the shelter and wait for the team with the stolen data to arrive, then blow it. Everyone leaves together, or no one does. It's not my first time on an op like this. You'll need a couple more vac suits, is all." Bobby didn't catch the important word until Clarissa spoke, her voice gentle and questioning, but Bobby heard the sharpness under it. "Your first time on an op like." "Who else?" Katria said. "If you want it done right, you get the best to do it. I'm the best. I make the charges. I place the charges. And it's my steady hand holding the detonator." The room was quiet, apart from the soft hiss of the air recyclers and the soft, harmonic thrum of the ship. The hint of old sewage smelled a little worse. Saba had only wanted the Voltaire Collective involved for material support. They weren't looking for another player when the operation took place. But telling Katria she couldn't be active in the field, would it insult her? And if it did, would that be enough to get her to turn on them?
"Sounds good," Amos said. "You and me on the demo team, Miss Kitty."
His smile was placid and empty. Bobby felt a shock of alarm. She met Holden's gaze and shook her head a millimeter. "This is a very bad idea." Holden swallowed, nodded, forced himself to smile as well.
"All right, then," Holden said. "Clarissa leads the support team on environmental controls for Alex. Alex pilots the drone swarm. Bobby and Naomi take care of the server, and Katria, Amos, and I will set the charges to cover it all up afterward.
Bobby leaned back, a lump forming in her gut.
Adding Holden in was not a better solution.
"This'll be great," Holden said.
Chapter 30. Sing. Sol operation nearing completion. Prepare initial shipping authorizations. Sing read Trejo's message over twice, joy blooming in his chest. He took a moment to send the order to his section heads and group commanders and pulled up what everyone jokingly called the occupation calendar. Even based on the amended projections from Laconia that included not pausing to rebuild the battery, the immediate transit of the Tempest to Sol system and the early deployment of the Typhoon, they were weeks ahead of schedule. They'd built some flex into the schedule in the event that the Transport Union put up a more bitter fight to hold Medina, or the Earth-Mars Coalition Navy had revealed naval forces or technology significantly greater than their estimates, but neither thing had turned out to be true. And sooner than anyone expected, they could get down to the business of building the new human civilization. The sad fact of the human species that High Consul Duarte understood so well was that you could never overcome tribalism and jingoism with an argument. Tribalism was an irrational position, and it was impossible to defeat an irrational position with a rational argument. And so, instead of presenting a logical plan for why humanity needed to give up the old national and cultural divides and become a single, unified species, the High Council obeyed the old forms that everyone would understand and went to war. Thankfully, a brief one. The real work, the work that would let Elsa grow up in a universe that was safe for her and for her children's children's children, was the work that came after the conquest of the rest of humanity. Work that required stability. Ensign, Sing said at his monitor, which was currently flattened out on his desk. He'd appointed a temporary replacement for Lieutenant Kasich, and he hadn't quite memorized her name yet.
"Governor," she replied a moment later.
"Please send my compliments to President Fisk and let her know we're sending a cart to pick her up. I need an immediate meeting to discuss some urgent matters. Do not take no."
"Yes, sir," the ensign replied.
"I also..." "Right away, ensign," Sing said, then took a look around at his office. The flowers someone had placed in a vase on his corner table were dying, and the shelf that held his coffee maker was a mess. "Also, send in someone to make fresh coffee and replace these flowers before the meeting."
"Yes, sir. I wanted to also let you know that you have an incoming message from Laconia. The storm just sent it over."
"Send it through. And please let me know 5 minutes before President Fisk arrives."
"Of course, sir," the ensign said, and then killed the connection.
Sing tapped on the glowing message button on his monitor, and it projected a still picture of his wife holding Monster.
"Play message," he said.
The still image sprang to life. The recording must have started midway through her expression, because Nat's face went from an enigmatic Mona Lisa smile to her normal wide grin. Monster didn't seem all that interested in the camera lens, and instead was focused on something over her mother's shoulder. They were both beautiful, and Sing felt an emptiness in the pit of his stomach that was always there, but that he managed to ignore until he saw their faces.
"Hi, Sonny," Nat said to the camera. She held up Monster's hand and waved at the screen with it.
"Say hi to Daddy."
"Hi, sweetie," Sing said to the recording like an idiot. He couldn't help himself.
"I know you're so busy right now, but we have some good news to pass along," Nat said. She put Monster down, and the girl ran out of frame. Sing felt irrationally disappointed to see her go. "My work with sheep modification has been approved for the next round of live testing," We could go wide with it in the next 30 months, which means a posting to Medina would actually help me move the project forward. No pressure or anything. She smiled as she said it, but he felt the loneliness echoed in her eyes. She continued, "Monster is doing well. She's a little bored and so ready to move into the big kid's room at school. She spends most afternoons with your dad, and they're becoming the best friends. She calls him Poompaw now, and he started insisting everyone else call him that, too. Most days he doesn't want me to take her when I get off work. We eat dinner at his place a lot of evenings." Singh felt a swell of love and gratitude for his father that he'd never felt before he had a child of his own. He paused the video playback and took a moment so he wouldn't get maudlin and weepy. It wouldn't do to bring Kerry Fisk in and begin delivering his orders while his eyes were goopy and red. When he'd gathered himself, he started it again. "So that's it, I guess. Reply when you get a minute." The home monitor has figured out Monster's version of the word play, so she loves replaying your messages over and over again. "Love you, Sonny. Be safe out there." And that was it. Nat, saying she loved him, shattered whatever resolve he thought he had, and he spent the next several minutes blubbering shamefully to himself. Someone tapped at his door, and he called out, "Give me a moment," then rushed off to his private bathroom. While he was washing his face, he heard the sounds of someone cleaning up his office, and by the time he'd put himself back in shape to see people, there was a fresh pot of coffee percolating on the shelf. A non-com was just finishing up by placing new flowers in his vase. The chief threw him a snappy salute, then faded out of the room like a cat. Singh sat at his desk, composed himself, then started a recording to Nat. "Hello, my dear. Thank you for the lovely message. I'm so happy to hear things are going well there, and Monster looks very well fed, so my father is almost certainly spoiling her rotten with sweet rolls. Things are still ahead of schedule here. Living here will take some getting used to, but there's plenty of usable land for your sheep and lab, and we're working to get all the services up to snuff for my little girl. Talk soon. I love you, Nat." "I love you." He almost said Monster, but something felt wrong about using her pet name. "I love you, Elsa." He killed the connection and sent the file for processing to pass down to Laconia with the next comm dump. He took a lot of pride in the fact that saying "I love you" to Nat hadn't sent him into another weeping fit. There were people who thought that sort of thing was unmanly. Singh didn't care about that, but it was undignified. 5 minutes, Ensign somebody said from his monitor. "I'm ready," he replied. Kerry Fisk sat in a chair in his office, drinking his coffee and looking twitchy and uncomfortable. She'd been picked up at her office by fully armored Marines and driven to the governor's offices in a convoy of three carts filled with other Marines. For her protection, certainly, but it could also be a little intimidating for someone who wasn't used to it. If that gave Singh a bit of home-field advantage when dealing with the minor functionaries on Medina, he'd happily take it. He waited until she'd stopped fidgeting and started paying attention to him, then pulled up a list of the hundreds of ring systems that had habitable colonies and threw the list up onto his wall. "Madam President," he said, "we've reached an exciting moment for us all, but especially for you as the first president of the Laconian Congress of Worlds." "Are we married to that name change?" she asked, "or..." "The name of the legislative body is established in the documentation I gave you after our first meeting. Did you not read those documents?"
"I did," she said.
"I just wasn't sure if that was a working title or not. We haven't voted on adopting the new..." "You do not vote on directives delivered from the executive authority of the High Council's office."
"I see," Fisk said.
She stared at her lap and blew steam off her coffee. As I was saying, Singh continued, this is an exciting time for us all. High Admiral Trejo has decided that our situation is now secure enough to allow limited trade to resume through the gates. Fisk looked up at him with genuine surprise. What? Yes, limited trade can be scheduled starting now. Put together a list of the worlds in the greatest need, as well as a schedule of deliveries that can meet those needs. Not from Sol system. Not yet. At first, we'll allow a single ship transit per week, and of course, each transit must be approved by me personally at least 30 days before it's scheduled to occur. That's actually, Fisk started, then stopped for a moment. That's actually really good to hear. There are a lot of colonies barely hanging on by a thread. This will save lives. And that is, of course, always the first priority of our respective positions. Ah, Fisk said, then leaned forward to put her coffee cup on the edge of his desk. As Singh frowned at it and the disrespectful informality it denoted, she said, on that topic, I passed along your threat to every colonized world. I also extended your invitation to the planets that have not already joined the association, the Laconian Congress of Worlds, to elect a representative to join our group once trade is resumed. I assume some of those planets will be asking to send their new reps along with the trade ships. That's good, Singh said. The Laconian Congress of Worlds was something High Consul Duarte insisted on to make the member worlds feel like they had a voice in government. As annoying as the idea of dealing with 1,300 Kerry Fisks would be, the High Consul's opinion on this topic had the force of law, so he'd do his best to see that the new legislative body succeeded. Fisk was still staring at him, waiting for some sort of answer. And? He asked. And if some of these transiting ships are carrying newly elected representatives, they'll need permission to dock or send shuttles to Medina. Does the lifting of the transit ban also include permission to dock with the station? Which was an excellent question, and Singh was annoyed that Kerry Fisk had thought of it before he did. Permission will be granted by this office on a case-by-case basis. Requests to be filed at minimum 30 days prior to transit, he said, feeling like it came across as established policy and not something he'd just made up on the spot. He'd need to document that once Fisk left. Thank you, Governor, Fisk said. It's important that this feel familiar, stable, and safe as quickly as possible, Singh told her. To the degree possible, you will use transport union ships and pilots. The union will also handle the pickup and delivery of goods using their existing policies. Other than the approval process for transits, everything should work the way it did before. I'll send out a notice to the union reps here on the station and to the local leadership on each world. Excellent, Singh said, standing up and reaching out to shake her hand. At the risk of sounding repetitive, these are very exciting times for us all. Fisk didn't stand. She sat in his chair, squeezing her hands and not looking at him. When the silence had become uncomfortable, he said, "Was there something else, Madam President?" "There is," she replied, looking him in the eye for the first time. She showed no sign of standing up to leave, so he sat back down again. "Then out with it," he said, immediately regretting the snappish tone. "Please." I'm doing everything you asked. I've passed along your messages to the worlds. I've asked for reps to be sent from every planet that wasn't already part of the association. I've passed along President Duarte's High Consul Duarte," Singh interrupted her. "Of course," she said. "I've passed along the High Consul's very detailed documentation on convening the new Congress of Worlds. Laconian Congress of Worlds," Singh said. "Of course. But so far, that's the only thing my office has done.
act as press secretary for your office. And, with all due respect, that is not what I was voted into my office to do. She looked nervous saying it, and Singh gave her a minute to stew in her worry. If the mouse wanted to grow some claws, that was probably a good thing in the long run. The Laconian government had no use for those who wouldn't fight for what they believed. The High Council made it very clear that every conflicting viewpoint should have a vigorous proponent, so that everyone felt that the final decisions were made only after everything was considered fully. A planetary congress run by mice wasn't useful to anyone. "And what," Singh said after he'd let her squirm enough, "would be a better use of your time, Madam President?" "If we're to be a legislative body of this new government, when do we actually start legislating? You've brought me in here to deliver these directives for me to disseminate, but not once have we voted on them. I feel that very quickly we'll be viewed as a Congress in name only, in place to rubber-stamp your orders." "As the governor," Singh replied, "I am here as the direct representative of the executive branch and the office of the High Council. You don't vote on orders from the High Council." He couldn't help but laugh a bit at the very ridiculousness of that idea, as if the High Council might change his policies because of a vote. "Then," Fisk replied, "what do we vote on?" "When the High Council's office is decided on this year's legislative agenda, you will be the first to be notified, Madam President. Until then, please continue working with the member worlds to ease their transition into the new government, and I assure you, that will be an excellent use of your time." "Okay," Carrie Fisk said and stood. "I'll just go make sure my rubber stamp is all warmed up." Singh didn't stand to shake her hand. "You're dismissed." Singh was still mulling over the deeply unsatisfying meeting he'd had with Carrie Fisk when his monitor buzzed and Overstreet's voice came over the speaker. "Sir, I have a gentleman who says he has important information for you." "Can't he give it to you?" "He's reluctant to, sir. Says it's for the top man only. I think it might be worth the interview." That was interesting. Even if the alleged information turned out to be nothing, he was curious to see what sort of thing Overstreet thought important enough to engage him. "Do we know this person?"
"No, sir," Overstreet replied. "I assume he's already been searched for weapons?"
"Yes, sir."
"Give me 2 minutes, then." And Singh closed the connection. His office was still neat and tidy from Fisk's visit. He sat up straighter in his chair and pulled his uniform jacket tight. He turned on his monitor's front-facing camera and examined himself. Secured and shipshape. The very picture of a military commander. There was a discreet knock, then two Marines walked in with Overstreet and a tall, thin man of the generic belter variety. The only feature this one had that seemed different at all was his comically large nose. It was misshapen from repeated breaks and had a large scar on one nostril. Clearly a man who'd been in a few fights and who did a poor job of keeping his hands up while boxing.
"You asked to see me," Singh said. He did not offer the man a chair.
"My sister in one of them cages you got out there," the man said, clearly working to keep his accent as belter-free as possible, and only sort of succeeding. Singh glanced at Overstreet.
"Not one of the people involved in the bombing, Governor," Overstreet said. "Petty theft from a merchant.
A military tribunal has been formed, and the cases will be adjudicated promptly and in the order they were filed," Singh replied.
"Is that all?"
It couldn't be, or Overstreet wouldn't have brought the man to his attention. But he was willing to let the belter do some of the work here.
"All that shit you said about we help you, you help us, that was just the merde, or what?"
"It's the truth," Singh said, feeling a glimmer of interest. Overstreet had what could have been the ghost of a smile on his lips.
Are you here to help me?
Let my sister go. She's just stupid. Caught stealing. No threat to you. Let her go. I know something you want to know.
The man rubbed his big, lumpy nose nervously as he spoke.
Something coming. And I know the coil behind, yeah? Deep in the Voltaire Collective, me.
You're in contact with the forces behind the bombing?
Maybe,
the broken-nosed man said. His bravado was barely thick enough to stretch across his fear.
If there's enough in it, you tell it to me.
Singh paused for a moment, letting the silence stretch. A network of locals loyal to him, dependent on his generosity. It was all coming together so well.
I think you and I are about to become friends, Singh said.
Chapter 31. Drummer. Sleep and Drummer had developed an uncomfortable relationship. Its worst aspect was the time it left her to read the public comment boards and news feeds.
This sense of purpose is exactly what Mars lost when the gates opened. This isn't an invasion at all. It's the return of the real Martian spirit to its proper place, and I am happy, fuck, delighted that I have lived long enough to see it.
The way it played out was predictable. During her days, she felt like people's home was turning too fast on its axis. Only it wasn't just her body that was getting spun. Her mind was too heavy to lift. She was controlling herself with a bad lag, like driving a mech with choppy software, or running a Waldo at the edge of its range. Meetings with the Union Board, with the EMC Admiralty, with her own staff, interviews and speeches in which she declared the independence of the Union. She got through all of them with a physical sensation like her brain was evaporating. All she wanted to do from the start of her shift to the last moment before bed was close her eyes. And then, as soon as she did, they opened again, as if by themselves.
These assholes should have been cut off before they could get through the gate. This is exactly the problem I've been talking about for years. A trade union doesn't matter for shit when an army comes knocking. If you ever needed any proof that the Transport Union Administration was incompetent, there you go. It's right here for you and in spades.
She'd tried to rest. Try to lure sleep back. Her eyes felt gritty. Her mouth felt dry. She wanted to eat, even though she wasn't hungry. Wanted water, even though she wasn't thirsty. It was like her body knew it needed something, and all it could do was run through the list of possibilities over and over, hoping that something would give her solace that hadn't the last time. She found herself craving a pipe full of marijuana, even though she hadn't smoked in decades. She waited an hour, maybe two, then got up and spooled through the feeds and networked discussions with a dummy account she'd made for the purpose. She told herself it was research, that she was gauging the morale of the populace. It was easy to pretend that she was somehow learning something that would help. It felt like tearing off a scab and pressing salt into the open sore, but it was better than paging through the names of the dead. Emily Santos Baca. From Ganymede, an independent journalist's 20-minute recording of the importance of solidarity in the face of the enemy. An old Earther's open letter about surviving the terrible years after the rocks fell and why this time was different. A round-table discussion by an open salon on Ceres about how the Union was or wasn't able to rise to the occasion and address the Laconian threat. A dozen languages. 1,000 faces and voices and rhetorical styles. If she was looking for clarity there, she didn't find it. My wife is on Medina Station.
I just got a message from her saying that the Laconian governor is offering better terms than the transport union did for everyone who works for them. And she said the technology that's coming through Laconia Gate is generations ahead of anything we have. I know it's not a popular opinion, but if they're going to treat the workers better, bring better equipment, and stay out of our business otherwise, I think our real enemy is the bureaucracy and the transport union offices. There were other voices, many more of them, really, that saw the attack on Medina for what it was. She read essays on defiance in the face of tyranny, listened to music designed to rally the patriotic against the enemy. A school on Luna had started a campaign where the children were dyeing their right hands red in defiance of Laconia. The symbolism of it escaped her, but the trend spread far past the school, and half of the interviewers and journalists on the feeds had some version of it. Red gloves, or finger sleeves, or rings. If she'd wanted to feel hopeful or resolved, it would have been easy to find those people and spend her insomniac hours only with them. But like a tongue prodding a sore tooth, she kept reaching for the others. Laconia is the future. The conquest is inevitable. Stop the war. Capitulate. There were also whole subfeeds devoted to speculating on the strategy of the EMC and the Union. Some of the conversations there were eerily like briefings from the EMC Admiralty. Others were desperation-fueled optimism dressed as military theory. None brought Drummer any more hope than she'd had before, and some left her mood darker. And she hadn't heard from Saba. Even when Medina lifted its comms blackout for propaganda, there'd been no message from him. From the others fighting against the occupation. She imagined that he was still there, sneaking between the decks like a rat made for gnawing through steel. That Medina would fall, and she'd hear his voice declaring their victory, or, failing that, that she'd hear his voice at all. And behind it all, pressing down on her soul like a suffocating hand, the tempest made its vast, stately way sunward, already past the halfway point, already breaking. She understood their strategy perfectly. A single ship, making its way for everyone in every system to see. It was a demonstration of authority, of inevitability, a piece of theater designed to humiliate, to subjugate, to control. It was what she had done to Freehold. That, as much as anything, kept her at the table in her quarters as the hours of sleeplessness slipped by. When she'd made the call, it had seemed like the obvious thing to do. Hard, yes, but in the service of a greater peace, a more orderly universe, someplace where there'd be some respect for the rules. The colonists on Freehold had made their choices. They'd broken the rules she and the people before her had set down. She'd felt justified when she sent the Rosinante. Now she wondered whether the colonists there had sat up in their beds in the night, wondered how they would feed their children, whether there was some way to finesse their way out of the future that was bearing down on them. Probably they had. Maybe this was the way the universe showed her the errors of her ways, taking the evil that she'd committed so offhandedly and turning it around to point at her. Her and Santos Baca. All the refugees of independence, all of the void cities dead. If it was, then the universe hadn't embraced the idea of proportional response yet. The small, quiet part of her mind that watched all the rest knew that she wasn't right. That there was no way for her to be right, not in a situation like this. If she'd been able to sleep, maybe. But the fear was eroding her bit by bit and taking away all the things that let her recover. Like a recycling pond with a plugged drain, she was filling with shit, and sooner or later she'd overspill. It wasn't a source of anxiety. It was just something she knew about herself, as if she were thinking about some different woman. She drew her robe closer around her chest, spooled through the feeds, watched a few seconds of the news from Londres Nova, a few seconds out of the shipyards at Tycho Palace Complex, Ceres, Luna, Earth, never enough to hear the whole story. Weirdly, not all of it was about Laconia. There was a fire at an arcology outside Paris. A popular musician Drummer had liked as a girl had died. It was as if not everything were defined by Laconia and Duarte and her own failures. And then the top traffic on the feed would resort, and there was an image of the Tempest in all its threat and glory. Holden had been right. Her plan for Freehold had been cruel, and she'd done it for the convenience of not being a government, not really, so that she could be unprepared when a navy no one knew existed arrived in force. She should have been kinder, wiser, more cunning. She should have been something other than what she was. There had to have been a moment when she could have chosen something different, when all of this could have been stopped. She couldn't think when it had been. Her system made its talk. If she'd been asleep, her lights would have come up. "Ma'am?" Vaughn said. Not even his nighttime staff. Whatever it was, they'd woken him up for it first, and he'd made the decision to wake her. That couldn't be good. "I'm awake," she said. "We've had a message for you from the Tempest. It came in on tight beam an hour ago. Signal intelligence says it's genuine." "Not broadcast?" "No, ma'am. Unencrypted, but not broadcast." Something the enemy wanted her and her people to see, but not as a press release. The switch in her mind flipped, and she wanted nothing more than to crawl into bed and sleep forever. "I'll take it in my room," she said. Her screen went dark, and then Admiral Trejo was on it, looking out at her as if he could actually see through the screen and light delay. His expression was almost rueful. That would be a pose, of course, a decision he'd made about how to appear. She hated that, even knowing that. She felt herself hoping he could be reasoned with, wanting to like him, because then maybe he'd like her. Stockholm Syndrome's first pale roots. She pushed the gentle impulse away and summoned up her hatred. "President Drummer," he said, "I hope I find you well. On behalf of High Consul Duarte, I'm asking again for the Transport Union ships to stand down and accept administration by the Laconian Empire, but I understand if that answer is still no. I'm going to keep asking until you change your mind, though. The sooner that comes, the less loss of life your people will suffer. Their fate is entirely up to you. If we do not have your unconditional surrender within 18 hours, though, then I'm afraid things will become less pleasant. I have been ordered to deny you the use of the shipyards at Palace Station. I'd rather get through this with the least loss of life and infrastructure. Again, entirely in your control. You can end this at any time. I am tendering a similar offer to the EMC, and I imagine you'll all want to talk this over. I urge you, in the strongest possible terms, to do the right thing and lay down your arms. The High Consul has given me a certain amount of latitude in how we bring this unpleasantness to a close, but the longer this drags on, the less freedom I'll have, and the worst-case scenario isn't something I relish. Confer with your colleagues at the EMC and reply back to me as soon as you can. If I don't hear from you, I'll assume you've chosen to protract this a little farther. The blood of Palace Station will be on your hands. I sincerely hope and pray that you'll be wiser than that."
He gave a little nod, and the message ended. Drummer's rage was sluggish and muddy from lack of sleep, but it was hot. She made the connection request, and